Now, shall we begin?
I think you can be that guy. I think you are ready to be that guy. Look around here. This? Well, it can all be yours. All you gotta do is answer one simple question. Who are you?
What's the cat got your tongue? You just overwhelmed by the awesomeness of this?
I'm gonna ask you one more time.
Poor, wretched, and stupid peoples, nations determined on your own misfortune and blind to your own good, you let yourselves be deprived before your own eyes of the best part of your revenues. Your fields are plundered, your homes robbed, your family heirlooms taken away. You live in such a way that you cannot claim a single thing as your own. And it would seem that you consider yourselves lucky to be loaned your property, your families, and your very lives, wrote the 16th century French jurist and philosopher Etienne de Labouette in his magisterial essay, The Politics of Obedience, The Discourse of Voluntary Servitude. All this havoc, this misfortune, this ruin descends upon you not from alien foes, but from the one enemy whom you yourselves render as powerful as he is, for whom you bravely go to war, for whose greatness you do not refuse to offer your own bodies unto death. He who thus domineers over you has only two eyes, only two hands, only one body, no more than is possessed by the least man among infinite numbers dwelling in your cities. He has indeed nothing more than the power that you confer upon him to destroy you. Where has he acquired enough eyes to spy upon you, if you do not provide them yourselves? How can he have so many arms to beat you with, if he does not borrow them from you? The feet that trample down your cities, where does he get them, if they are not your own? How does he have any power over you except through you? How would he dare assail you, if he had no cooperation from you? What could he do to you if you yourselves did not connive with the thief who plunders you, if you were not accomplices of the murderer who kills you, if you were not traitors to yourselves? You sow your crops in order that he may ravage them. You install and furnish your homes to give him goods to pillage. You rear your daughters that he may gratify his lust. You bring up your children in order that he may confer upon them the greatest privilege he knows, to be led into his battles, to be delivered to butchery, to be made the servants of his greed and the instruments of his vengeance. You yield your bodies unto hard labor in order that he may indulge in his delights and wallow in his filthy pleasures. You weaken yourselves in order to make him the stronger and the mightier to hold you in check. From all these indignities, such as the very beasts of the field would not endure, you can deliver yourselves if you try, not by taking action, but merely by willing to be free. Resolve to serve no more, and you are at once freed. The opposite of freedom is allegiance. That is to say, recognizing somebody or something as your liege or your lord. One of the really interesting paradoxes of the system under which we live is the idea that citizenship is somehow a greater privilege than individual liberty. And that somebody who comes here to this country must be naturalized and become a citizen, be made a citizen, in order to enjoy some type of status under law that is supposedly more to be coveted than that of the free individual living in peaceful cooperation through contract and covenant and commerce with others. And this leads me to a story out of where else? Texas. Donald Trump's election looms over a U.S. citizenship ceremony in San Antonio as the judge presiding over the ceremony says, if you don't like that Trump will be president, go to another country. I can assure you that whether you voted for him or you did not vote for him, if you are a citizen of the United States, he is your president, Judge John Promono said. He will be your president, and if you do not like that, you need to go to another country. This is a subject about which I spoke at length last week, but it bears, I think, further examination. Herewith, I will recite to you what the U.S. Constitution outlines in terms of the delegated powers exercised by the occupant of the Oval Office. Constitution of the United States, Article 2, Section 2, the President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the Militia of the several states when called into the actual service of the United States. That's a function. That is not a title. He is Commander-in-Chief of the military only when they are activated by Congress. And the unorganized citizens' militia is no longer under this constitutional provision subsequent to the Dick Act, the Militia Act of 1906. Which, by the way, is when the oath of citizenship was revised, too. That's an interesting subject about which I'll probably have more to say later. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officer in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices, and he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States except in cases of impeachment. That's paragraph 1 from section 2. Herewith is paragraph 2, section 2 of article 2. Of the United States Constitution. He, meaning the President, shall have power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the Senators present to concur, and he shall nominate, and by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, shall appoint ambassadors and other public ministers and consuls, judges of the Supreme Court, and all other officers of the United States, whose appointments are not herein otherwise provided for, and which shall be established by law. But the Congress may by law vest the appointment of such inferior officers as they think proper in the President alone, in the courts of law, or in the heads of departments. The President shall have power to fill up all vacancies that may happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next session. Three austere paragraphs, one of which is a single sentence, define the extent of the constitutionally delegated powers of the President of the United States, and not a syllable in this provision of the Constitution describes a grant of authority to the President over any citizen who is not a member of the executive branch or an enlistee in the United States military when the military has been called into the service of the United States by the Congress. There's not a syllable in this document that describes an obligation that any citizen has to the President of the United States. If you're not a member of the executive branch or an active duty member of the United States military that has been activated by Congress, you don't have a president under the United States Constitution. He is peripheral to your concerns, or at least he should be, if the office bore any resemblance at all in its current iteration to what was created by the framers of the United States Constitution. We should have nothing to do with the President of the United States as private citizens. I don't think that prior to the advent of Woodrow Wilson, who is currently in hell lifting up his eyes in torment, I am confident, that most American citizens knew who the President of the United States was. And those who knew probably didn't care a whole lot. Wilson was really the first to use, in rudimentary form, the modern media to make the presidency the cynosure of American life. And it's gotten worse since then. One of the most fascinating aspects of the oath of naturalization that has been sworn by people who have become citizens of the United States by choice rather than by birth is that in every version of that oath, there has been a provision in which the individual renounces his allegiance or obedience to foreign kings and potentates and rulers. The problem here is that over the decades, over the centuries, really, beginning roughly in 1795, unfortunately, the idea has taken root that citizenship consists of duties and obligations to the state, to the government of the United States, and the people who run it. And I will have a great deal more to say on that unsettling topic when I return. This is Will Grigg with Freedom's Other Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. Please stand by for more sedition after this. It may be of interest to you that the part of the Constitution that everybody likes, the Bill of Rights, does not contain the word citizen. It mentions persons, that is to say individual human beings, and also people, which are groups of the same. None of the guarantees of protection against government violence, which of course are porous and highly qualified and of dubious value given the consummate criminality of the federal government, none of the guarantees stated in the Bill of Rights is contingent upon citizenship. The assumption is that anywhere the United States government claims jurisdiction, it is supposedly limited by the provisions of the Constitution and by the prohibitions and guarantees of the Bill of Rights. Citizenship has nothing to do with this. I find it also interesting that the naturalization oath of allegiance to the United States of America doesn't contain the word liberty and doesn't contain the concept of individual liberty. I hereby declare on oath that I absolutely and entirely renounce and abjure all allegiance and fidelity to any foreign prince, potentate, state, or sovereignty of whom or which I have heretofore been a subject or citizen. That would be a very good place to stop. Unfortunately, it proceeds further, that I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That likewise would be a good place to stop, bearing in mind, of course, that the Constitution is a flawed instrument and that the laws of the United States are largely abhorrent. Indeed, nobody really knows how many laws we're supposedly accountable to obey. Alas, the oath continues, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, there's that troublesome word, allegiance, that I will bear arms on behalf of the United States, meaning, of course, the government of the United States, when required by the law, that I will perform non-combatant service in the armed forces of the United States when required by the law, that I will perform work of national importance under civilian direction when required by law. Those provisions, actually, those are three ways of stating essentially the same proposition, are actually derivative of the Communist Manifesto. That's something I've written about extensively. Conscription is a communist concept, whether you're talking about a levée en masse of the sort that was used by the Jacobins in the late 18th century, or whether you're talking about military conscription, involuntary servitude for the purpose of military slavery. These are practices that are, of course, consummately unconstitutional. The 13th Amendment does not admit exceptions for compelled military service. Interestingly, it shouldn't admit exceptions for compelled jury service either. These are three different ways of stating the same proposition. If you become a naturalized citizen, you are pledging on oath, in the name of the Creator, as it turns out, that you offer yourself as property to the United States government to use as your new prince, potentate, or sovereign would deem suitable, and that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, so help me God. This oath, as it now stands, was revised somewhat a few years ago, and the Obama administration's intention in doing so was largely and widely misrepresented. The administration is liable for criticism on many, many fronts, entirely valid and necessary criticism. Mr. Obama and his administration were accused of denaturing the oath of naturalization by supposedly relieving newly naturalized citizens of the responsibility to defend the country. Obviously, that's not the case. He actually expanded this in a way that brings within the ambit of coercion people who, for reasons of conscience, would not countenance being required to bear arms on behalf of the government. Now they're simply saying that they will make themselves available for whatever purposes the government would deem necessary. Interestingly enough, back in 2003, under the administration of George W. Bush, there was a rejected updating of the Oath of Naturalization that contained pretty much the same thing in substantive terms, but in language that was modernized, less archaic, and more easily understood. This is the rejected 2003 version of the Oath of Allegiance. Solemnly, freely, and without mental reservation, I hereby renounce under oath all allegiance to any foreign state. My fidelity and allegiance from this day forward is to the United States of America. I pledge to support, honor, and be loyal to the United States, its Constitution, and its laws. Where and if lawfully required, I further commit myself to defend the Constitution and laws of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, either by military, non-combatant, or civilian service. This I do solemnly swear, so help me God. In substance, it's very similar to what prevails now under the Obama administration, and it has the same liabilities and the same defects, in my opinion, because once again, it places the state at the center of the moral and ethical obligations of the citizen. The first oath of allegiance that was sworn by Americans had nothing at all whatsoever to do with pledging loyalty to a government beyond defending the United States from a foreign aggressor. May 11, 1778, at Valley Forge during the Revolutionary War, we have one extant copy of an oath sworn by James Glentworth, the lieutenant of the 6th Pennsylvania Regiment. I, James Glentworth, lieutenant of the 6th Pennsylvania Regiment, do acknowledge the United States of America to be free, independent, and sovereign states, and declare that the people thereof owe no allegiance or obedience to George III, King of Great Britain, and I renounce, refuse, and abjure any allegiance or obedience to him, and I do swear that I will, to the utmost of my power, support, maintain, and defend the said United States against the said King George III, his heirs and successors, and his or their abettors, assistants, or adherents, and will serve the said United States in the office of lieutenant, which I now hold with fidelity according to the best of my skill and understanding. James Glentworth, sworn at the Valley Forge Camp this 11th day of May, 1778, before me, Sterling M.G. That was the first oath of allegiance to the United States that was ever sworn by an American citizen, in this case a citizen of Pennsylvania, because the United States of America was still an inchoate proposition at the time. The first naturalization law in 1790, which was enacted by the first United States Congress, provided for an oath of citizenship to be sworn by those who were being naturalized as citizens. The interesting thing is that that piece of legislation did not specify the terms of the oath. Someone who had lived in the United States may be admitted to become a citizen thereof on application to any common law court of record in any one of the states wherein he shall have resided for the term of 1 year at least, and making proof to the satisfaction of such court that he is a person of good character, and taking the oath or affirmation prescribed by law to support the Constitution of the United States. Once again, there's nothing there about an obligation to take up arms on behalf of the government. There's nothing here about being subservient to whatever the legislature might enact and call law. The idea was that you became a naturalized citizen of the United States by proving that you were a person of good character and swearing that you would uphold the Constitution. That's how the framers designed it in any case. It was a much better system than the one we have now. I'll be back in just a minute.
Do that to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges.
I don't mean to disparage the concept of citizenship as innately worthless, nor do I intend to repudiate my citizenship by birth here in the United States. I do think that we need to examine somewhat skeptically the value of citizenship in principle. It seems to me that the chief advantage of citizenship is the implied promise that the U.S. government will, under at least some circumstances, protect the citizen from unauthorized violence committed by foreign interests or foreign individuals, and that it does so as part of exercising its proprietary claim on that U.S. citizen. It's somewhat akin to the famous line from the movie Animal House. They can't do that to our pledges. Only we can do that to our pledges, exclaimed fraternity leaders as they witnessed one of their fraternity pledges being abused by the commander of the ROTC unit. One of the things about the protective function of citizenship that I find interesting is the fact that under Roman law, citizens apparently enjoyed greater security of person than U.S. citizens enjoy when confronted by a law enforcement official. This is something that is recorded in the 22nd chapter of the book of Acts. Now, this is an historic account. It doesn't involve anything transcendent or metaphysical. It simply describes what happened when Paul the Apostle, who was always getting into trouble, traveled to Jerusalem and started to preach the Christian gospel before a crowd that didn't particularly care for him. At one point, he said something that the crowd found to be unconscionable. They raised their voices, says Acts chapter 21, verse 22, and shouted, "Rid the earth of him, he's not fit to live." As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander, that is to say the commander of the local Roman garrison, ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. In other words, he was arrested. He was detained for questioning. The commander directed that he be flogged and interrogated in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. As they stretched him out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, "Is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty?" When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. "What are you going to do?" he asked. "This man is a Roman citizen." The commander went to Paul and asked, "Tell me, are you a Roman citizen?" "Yes, I am," Paul replied. Then the commander said, "I had to pay a lot of money for my citizenship." He was a naturalized Roman citizen, in other words. "But I was born a citizen," Paul replied. Verse 29, I think, is the key element of this narrative. Those who were about to interrogate him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. There are several other translations of this passage to talk about the fact that he had bound a Roman citizen who had not been convicted of a crime. In other words, he had shackled him or handcuffed him on the basis of suspicion rather than conviction of an offense. It's entirely routine here in the United States today for entirely innocent people who were involved in some kind of a street contact with a police officer or even a traffic stop to be handcuffed supposedly for their own protection. And the reason why this is described as a protective function is because the police officer acting on the principal officer safety uber alle needs to be protected from any potential threat from the citizen. And if he is put in fear for his life for any trivial or transitory reason, he very well could kill that citizen. So in order to protect the citizen against the potential criminal violence from the law enforcement officer, the citizen is bound. Being bound is an injury. It was an illegal injury under Roman law for citizens. Not everybody born within the realm was a citizen. But it was unlawful for a citizen to be bound without being convicted of an actual offense. So the protection that is offered to citizens under American law is to that extent inferior to what existed under imperial Roman law. The other thing I find quite interesting is that you cannot unilaterally renounce your citizenship. If you want to repudiate your citizenship and expatriate yourself, for instance, in order to escape the dead hand of the regulatory state or to try to abate the tax burdens that are imposed upon you by the government that claims you, you have to swear an oath. I desire and hereby make a formal renunciation of my U.S. nationality as provided by Section 349A5 of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952 as amended, and pursuant thereto, I hereby absolutely and entirely renounce my United States nationality together with all rights and privileges and all duties and allegiance and my fidelity thereunto pertaining. I make this renunciation intentionally, voluntarily, and of my own free will, free of any duress or undue influence. Incidentally, what rights do you repudiate by renouncing your citizenship? Rights are not a function of citizenship. They inhere in the individual as a consequence of that individual's existence. They're not contingent upon citizenship, including due process rights under the United States Constitution. So what rights are you giving up? Well, the right to vote, that is to say, to engage in a type of sacralized plunder, a type of participatory larceny involving the exercise of power over other people. That's one right, quote-unquote, that one would relinquish, I suppose. The supposed right to receive plundered largesse in the form of welfare payouts. Again, these are not legitimate rights. The document from the Bureau of Consular Affairs points out that a renunciation of United States nationality and citizenship is effective only upon approval by the U.S. Department of State, but when approved, the loss of nationality citizenship occurs as of the date the above oath affirmation was taken. In other words, you don't get to leave the club until they let you leave the club, and even when you do, you are not free from the malign supervisory attention of the state that you had just repudiated. Some of you might be acquainted with the case of the late Bobby Fischer, the chess phenom with a reported IQ of 181, and that is an entirely plausible report from my perspective, who apparently succumbed to a species of derangement and expatriated himself, and in 1992 committed the supposedly grievous act of playing chess against Boris Spassky, whom he had defeated 20 years earlier, becoming the first American chess master to win the World Chess Championship, and winning, I believe, something on the order of $140,000 when that was real money. Bobby Fischer in 1992 had the temerity to play chess to have a rematch against Boris Spassky. He did so in the former Yugoslavia, at a time when there were sanctions that had been imposed by the first Bush administration that supposedly prohibited U.S. citizens from doing business in or with the government of Yugoslavia. The World War I era law that deals with sanctions of that kind requires a formal declaration of war in order for such sanctions to be imposed, because sanctions are an act of war. It really is implausible that the terms and conditions of that law apply to U.S. citizens acting in a private capacity. Bobby Fischer was subject, nonetheless, to an arrest warrant. And so he spent the remaining years of his life, the remaining 16 years of his life, not only in exile, but as a fugitive. Because had he found himself in a country that would honor an extradition request, if he found himself on territory regarded as part of the sovereign realm of the United States, he would have been arrested and extradited to the United States to stand trial for the supposed grievous offense of playing chess without government permission. In a 2004 article examining the process of renouncing one's citizenship and dealing specifically with the case of Bobby Fischer, author Brennan Corner pointed out that the renunciation must take place in a foreign country and the State Department reserves the right to reject the citizen's attempt to ditch their citizenship. The oath must also be signed in person, so the 3-page letter that Fischer has sent to the U.S. Embassy isn't good enough, nor would it be enough for one of his representatives, say someone from the Tokyo-based Committee to Free Bobby Fischer, to show up at the embassy and sign the required documents. If Fischer is planning to renounce his citizenship in order to avoid American prosecution, continues Corner, he could be in for a rude surprise. The State Department's primer on renunciation clearly states that the act of renouncing U.S. citizenship will not allow the person to avoid possible prosecution for crimes which they may have committed in the United States. But Fischer played a chess game in Yugoslavia. It matters not to the sovereign. Since Fischer violated a travel ban issued by a federal agency, Corner continues, his crime, I would put the term crime in scare quotes, is probably not exempt from that provision regardless of the fact that it involved Yugoslavia. That is because the empire does not recognize any limits on either its powers or its jurisdiction. I'll be back in just a few minutes. The 1795 naturalization law was the first in the history of the United States to define citizenship in terms of what we would now call national security. The 1790 Act simply required those who wanted to become citizens of the United States to profess loyalty and fidelity to the United States Constitution, which is an instrument intended to bind the government. From 1795 forward, citizenship has been defined in terms of the needs of the national government, rather than the duty of the citizen to keep the national government within its constitutional cage. There's a very fascinating essay written by Dr. Gerhard Casper of Stanford University. It was the Maurice and Muriel Fulton Lecture in Legal History at the University of Chicago Law School in May of 2008. The essay is entitled Forswearing Allegiance. He talks about the fact that the 1795 Act was the first to contain this very strong language talking about forswearing previous allegiances. The 1795 legislation, explains Dr. Casper, became a substitute for the 1790 Naturalization Act, the first of its kind at the federal level, that had required only 2 years of residence, good character, not good moral character, and a simple oath to support the Constitution of the United States. James Madison, the sponsor of the revisions that were introduced in December of 1794, thought that the 1790 law had not duly guarded against intrusions and evasions, and that the progress of things in Europe was exposing the United States to very serious inconveniences. While we cannot be sure what precisely Madison had in mind when he made these observations, the likeliest explanation is his fear that laws favoring citizens could be subverted by easy naturalization of foreign, especially British, subjects. Earlier in the year, Madison had been engaged in a major, if unsuccessful, effort to promote restrictions on British shipping and trade through sweeping duties on tonnage and imports. There's this hybrid of national security concerns and economic protectionism at work. Even Homer nods, and even Madison, in my opinion, made serious errors with respect to limiting power through the Constitution. I had previously referred to the fact that citizenship is a very ambiguous shield against abuses of power by the United States government, as opposed to foreign governments that would not have a proprietary claim on the United States citizen in question. An attorney and law professor by the name of William C. Bradford, who until recently was an instructor at West Point, is of the opinion that people who criticize the federal government's policies with respect to the so-called global war on terror are effectively repudiating their citizenship and becoming de facto enemy combatants. Bradford would designate as enemy combatants those who criticize the U.S. government's foreign policy or offer to defend suspected terrorists out of a commitment to due process in the Bill of Rights, assuming that those people are attorneys, members of the bar. Being branded in this fashion, attorneys and scholars would be eligible for the full menu of punitive options currently used by the U.S. government, including extrajudicial arrest and indefinite detention, trial by military tribunals as opposed to Article III courts, torture, and even summary execution. The West must shatter Islamists' political will and eradicate those who do not renounce Islamism, insisted Bradford in a 185-page harangue entitled The Treason of the Clerics, The Critical Law of Armed Conflict Academy as an Islamist Fifth Column. It was published in the spring-summer 2015 issue of the National Security Law Journal. Bradford continues, all instruments of national power, including conventional and nuclear force and psyops, that is to say psychological warfare operations, must be harnessed to capture the hearts and minds of Islamic peoples, break their will to fight for Islamism, and leave them prepared to coexist with the West or be utterly eradicated. In confronting what he describes as an existential crisis, Bradford makes the following assertion, survival is its own justification. In other words, there's no law but necessity. From his perspective, there is no room for what he calls legal fetishists who are skeptical of decisions by the executive or military leadership. Quote, Americans are entitled not only to political leaders who employ all necessary measures, but to the strong presumption that such measures are legal and to the salutary effects of this presumption upon their belief in the virtue of their cause and their will to fight for it. In other words, one dimension of citizenship is slavish, reflexive devotion to the executive branch and the military, and the assumption that you do not have the right to be skeptical of their exercise of power. You are to be complacent, not critical, if you were a citizen, from the perspective of this fellow who was until recently teaching at West Point. And by the way, he was cashiered from West Point not because of anything he had taught, but because it turned out that he had falsified his military history by claiming commendations he had not earned. Fighting total war demands a mental reconfiguration on the part of the public by resolving arguments over how to balance security and liberty in favor of security. If you're a citizen, you define yourself in terms of what is convenient for the government and what enhances the government's definition of security. Liberty is not part of the equation. Once again, remember what the naturalization oath says with respect to the role of the individual. It is to make himself available for whatever purpose the United States government deems necessary. Bradford insists that acculturating the necessary fighting spirit in the population through mass propaganda is appropriate, and where possible, conspicuous punishment of dissidents should be carried out to serve that purpose. I quote again, Spartanization of the West will require the deepening of the concept of citizenship to include duties as well as rights. Rights are attended by corresponding duties, and the state may obligate citizens, even academics, to contribute to the struggle in those ways they are able. I advert yet again to the naturalization oath. That's the promise that you make when you become a naturalized citizen of the United States. You're promising to consecrate yourself to what the state would deem the purposes of the polity. Refusal to acknowledge the Islamist threat as an existential challenge to Western civilization and to unite to defeat that threat would be the greatest dereliction of duty in history, insists Bradford. To wage total war against this apparently all but omnipresent enemy, all restrictions on government power must be supplanted by what Bradford calls the law of armed conflict, or LOAC. In this, the executive is emancipated from checks and balances, and the constitutional subordination of the military to civilian control is reversed. It is the military upon whom the constitutional duty to defend Americans is incumbent, and in whom Americans must repose trust. Bradford refers to legal and scholarly critics of the open-ended war on terrorism as the Critical Law of Armed Conflict Academy. That's a really contrived expression that was created, I suspect, for the express purpose of justifying the pungently dismissive acronym CLOACA. While admitting that no membership role exists of this supposed fifth column and declining to name specific examples, and I think he did that most likely out of a desire to avoid civil liability, Bradford maintains that scholars who fit within that amorphous category constitute an Islamist fifth column, even when no evidence of conscious collaboration exists. Scholarship that challenges the autonomy of the Pentagon, which cannot be autonomous, or dismisses military wisdom by questioning the legality, constitutionality, or morality of foreign wars, indefinite detention of suspects, or the use of torture, the use of drone strikes. These are not mere academic exercises from Bradford's perspective. Instead, he describes them as a form of advocacy that attenuates U.S. arms and undermines American will, and are psyops, which are combatant acts. As propaganda inciting others to war crimes, such acts are prosecutable. He continues, Cloaca members are thus combatants who, like all other combatants, can be targeted at any time and place and captured and detained until termination of hostilities, without judicial recourse. Assuming that so-called Cloaca members would be treated in the same fashion as their supposed comrades among Islamists, they would be subject to judicial execution post-interrogation if this were considered justifiable as a matter of military necessity. Predictably, Bradford observes that enemy combatants may be targeted and killed wherever and whenever they can be found, and that UAWs, that is to say missile-bearing drones, as with other weapons systems, do not require that targets of targeted killing be afforded a warning or judicial process before use. And that is based on precedents that were set primarily by Barack Obama. President-elect Donald Trump has said that drone strikes would continue to be part of the arsenal of the open-ended war on terror. One thing about this 185-page diatribe by Bradford that I find remarkable is the fact that the threshold that he sets for treatment of the kind he describes is astonishingly low. Academic dissenters who publicly describe the U.S. government as an aggressor, and I'm quoting now from Bradford, or employer of illegal methods and means, or cast aspersions on U.S. motives, close quote, for carrying out military operations display, quote, an intent to betray the United States, close quote, or give aid and comfort to the enemy. Those thus identified would be subject to what Bradford calls a counterattack. Think of that for a second. You criticize the United States military. That means that, under the doctrine sketched out by Mr. Bradford, the federal government would be entitled to mount a counterattack involving a range of options drawn from what he calls a continuum of increasing coercion, including mandatory loyalty oaths, termination from employment, formal criminal charges for, quote, material support of terrorism or even treason, the last being a capital offense. In that fashion does the concept of citizenship become an open-ended death warrant for those who dissent. It should surprise us not at all to see that Mr. Bradford is wetting his pants in eagerness to be appointed to a position within the Trump administration. I was anti-radical Islam before it was cool, he wrote in a sycophantic tweet just this morning, November 19th. President Trump, I'm ready, willing, and able to help destroy this evil. He's also indecently eager to destroy what remains of civil liberties and due process. Thank you for joining me this week on Freedom Zealot Radio. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com and the new libertarianinstitute.org. I will return in a week, and until then, as always, doom spirito pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, God bless, and may we send the state back to the hell that spawned it.
What do you want to do now, Captain?
The same thing we always do. Fight them until we can't.